Hi, everyone. My name's Christine Dazan. I teach at Harvard Law School courses that are about money, money as an institution and as a practice, what it is, how we could reform it to make it more just. And that's a tall order because I think we have a pretty inequitable system at the moment in terms of the way the monetary system works. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk here, because my work really connects to yours, at least as if I'm understanding the project that you're doing, and as I think about what I do. As I understand the Farm Force project, it's really about creating new modes of farming that create rich soils, communities that flourish, mutually beneficial ways of valuing and exchanging resources. And the issue is, how do we fund that? How do we finance that? Current modes of finance channel profits to investors who are interested in maximizing their take, and those investors do not always prioritize items of social welfare or practices of social welfare. That includes the modes of farming that you are trying to develop. That means that funding within the current system comes with conditions that could limit or detract from your effort. I think the solution is redesigning money and redesigning finance and access to the resources that it represents. And there are some promising options. They include public banking, direct issue dollars, mutual credit networks. None of them would be easy to install within the current political system, within current politics, but I do think we want to put them on the radar. So I think I'm kind of the Saturday night relief from the field. And in some ways, it's kind of a utopian project what we're going to embark on this evening as we try to think through the way that new modes of finance might connect to what you're doing. I'm going to say at the very outset that I will talk about several things, three things. My idea in speaking with Jen is to talk first about what money is in the first place, because we need to know what money is if we want to try to redesign it or create fairer ways of money creation and money allocation. And then I'll talk about the fact that there are different ways of designing money, and we'll talk about a few of those designs. And third, I'll talk about some particular designs that might be better suited to funding efforts like the Farm Force project and the kind of transformative agriculture that you are trying to do. It would be very helpful to me to take any questions that occur to you as they come. I mean, especially if something sounds confusing, we should talk about it and get it straight. I will stop every once in a while to invite questions in particular, but I'm assuming it's a very informal setting. So I'm happy to make this more of a discussion than me, talking about a bunch of points. And I'll ask Jen or Michael to flag your questions because I can't really see the people in the room well. So, but feel free to send, put your hand up or make it clear you want to make a comment or have a question. Okay, so the first question is the first item that I mentioned we talk about is what money is anyway. And the most important point maybe of the night is to remember that money, let's see if I can figure out how to use my clicker. Okay. Money is a public creation. It's an IOU from the government. What do I mean by that? That's not the usual way that we think about money. If you asked somebody on the street what money is, they'd probably say it's a thing. And if you asked where it came from, it's a thing that makes exchange easier. If you ask economists what money is, they'll say it's something lying around that people began to use to measure and stand in for values. So here's the Here's the old barter story. People were exchanging lots of things, sheep for goats, hay for work on the farm, right? Everyone's exchanging things. And it's really hard to make exchanges because when you have something like hay, you're not sure that the person you want to hire actually wants the hay. You might have to go sell the hay, give the hay to someone else for food and then give the food to the person you want to hire. There are all these awkward problems with barter. And the way the economists think of money, which has become very much the public myth about money, is that as people were trying to make all these exchanges, the things that were easy to buy and sell rose to the surface, or the things that everybody wanted rose to the surface. Sorry, just I've got a new clicker here, and it's a bit confusing to me. So anyway, as people were trying to make exchanges, certain things were easier. Everybody wanted them, like gold and silver. And those things kind of rose to the surface of barter and became the things that people worked with more and more. And they became money. And eventually the government kind of got involved and standardized that kind of money. Once silver and gold coin went out of fashion and we started using paper, the story kind of gets updated and it goes like this. Well, everyone knew that a dollar could be exchanged for gold, and so people finally agreed just to dispense with the gold and hold on to the dollar. So the dollar is kind of conventionally accepted. Everyone uses it because everyone else is using it, and everyone just trusts it. This is, if you listen to it, getting more and more fictional, right? I mean, people have millions of dollars in invested in dollars, and it's not that likely that they would just be relying on a convention, but that's the story. We can fit in banking into the economist story. That story is, people were leaving gold and silver with the merchants, and the merchants were lending it to each other. And eventually, we just began leaving our gold and silver with the merchants, and they were holding on to it and giving out pieces of paper to represent it. And so we finally decided we could do without the silver and gold, and we just started using the pieces of paper. So it's all just kind of an evolutionary organic story. It's a good story. You've heard it often. Here's the catch. There's no evidence that anything like that ever happened. If you think about it at the simplest level, it's a story that requires enough of a market to produce the medium that's supposed to make the market, right? It's a very circular story in the first place. And a second reason that it's unlikely it ever happened is nobody has things like silver and gold lying around and just, has enough of that kind of material that's durable and precious that they're willing to just try exchanging it with people as a stand-in for other things. So certainly not silver and gold. And finally, there's just no evidence historically when people look for that kind of story, it doesn't happen that way. But if the story's fictional, it still has a lot of powerful implications, and they've taught us lessons that are actually wrong about money. But if you hear this, or if you think through the implications, you'll see what I mean. So the first implication of that story is, money is produced by private exchange, just people acting one with another, right? People are making bilateral trades, acting as individuals. Money arises out of their deals. They're all acting in their own self-interest. Money is spread around pretty widely. It comes to hand and therefore rises to the surface of exchange. Everyone's has kind of equal access or approximately equal access to money. Everyone picks it, that is, opts in to the monetary world. It arises by consent, in other words. And communities and politics and governments are pretty insignificant. They don't really matter in the story. It's really all private exchange. And if you think about money that way, which the economists often do, then the market itself, just without more, looks pretty democratic. Given that there's no evidence that money arose that way, we should ask actually, so why do we believe this? And we should take a second look at those implications. In particular, when we look at how money really arose, it's more like this. People operate in communities as well as individual market-driven players, right? That is, groups are as important as individuals are, and groups are sustained by the contributions of their members. So money occurs when people repackage those contributions. Imagine a small community, pre-money, and everyone is cooperating to keep the community going and to keep the community safe. So everyone gives a certain amount of labor every week or every month to keep their community going. An emergency occurs, so a dam breaks, or the community in, the 5th century is attacked by another group. So what do you do if you're relying on people to give their labor only periodically? What you do is you ask people to work early in an emergency to provide, service fixing the dam, let's say. And then when they've done that service, you give them an IOU, a credit that says you've done your work for the next week or for the next month. You did it early when we needed you. And when the time comes for that person to make their recurring contribution, they can give you back the token. They can give the token back to the stakeholders for the community, right? Back to the central authorities or the chiefs or, the council that's running the society. All you have to do at that, so if you think about that, that's a very different approach to thinking about money. It's instead a kind of collective credit that is given to some people in advance, within a group who already share mutual obligations. And the reason that money holds value is that everyone knows what that obligation is worth, right? Because the credit, the token that people hold for doing their work early is worth one quota of work of labor that they are responsible for giving the community. After that, all you have to do is make that token transferable. And you will actually see money take shape because then people will start using that token at a value that they know is certain, right? They all owe labor, so they all know what it's worth, and they can use it among themselves before their labor's due. That's a huge kind of innovation within communities because it means that communities can spend early and can spend to certain people so they can start tailoring their practices and start doing things like developing bureaucracies, developing court systems and police forces and road crews whom they pay with this money. And then they tax more generally, they accept the money back in lieu of the material value that people would otherwise have to share with the community and have agreed to share. If you think about that approach to money, it's a very different idea, right? It means that communities are important as individuals. Money comes about when we have mutual obligations to each other. Money arises out of those obligations. It also means the way it's spent into circulation matters. It gets to certain people first. So this is not a story of easy equality. It's a story that we'd have to actually think about the market and think about creating equality. This also means that money, when it enters circulation, is reorganizing relations between people. It's reorganizing the capacity of the center, right? The stakeholders for the community can now do a lot more with their money. And it reorganizes the way people relate to each other. I'm just going to try, hopefully. Okay, here's the basic logic that I just described. And if you look at this diagram, you see that you see an example, you see the logic that I just sketched out. I'll give you a very specific example of a time that it happened in the United States. So if we want a very clear example of money coming into being, we need to just look at the Civil War. So the Civil War, 1861, found the North and the South basically with very little money in their treasuries. So the North, the Union, had about $2 or $3 million, and it needed almost overnight, in order to mobilize armies and send them into the field and take care of them, it needed about 300 million. It was an almost impossible situation. So what the Union government did, first of all, they debated, they went into emergency meeting, and they debated what the possibilities were. Couldn't figure out how to make money. And literally what they did is pay soldiers and suppliers with IOUs. These were the greenbacks, and you can see the logic there. They're spending IOUs, and the greenback said, here's the greenback. This is $1 if you see the front of the greenback. And if you see the back, which is why it was called a greenback, you'll see the logic was, you can pay, use this greenback for all debts, public and private, right? You'll be able to use that. So let me see if I can go back. The greenback goes out. If you see on top the government spending, people then give the greenback back to the dollar when they're back to the government when they're taxed. And that is a kind of supply and demand, you can think of it. Money going out, the demand for money by the government means that money will hold its value. Of course, it's wartime, they have all sorts of problems, but it basically works. And that's the most basic form of money, an IOU by the government that citizens hold and can give back to the government. And as I said, here's the one of the first most transparent IOUs, and here's that legal promise that you can give this back for all debts, public and private. Let me stop there and see if anybody has questions. I've also, Jen, managed to evaporate the meeting. I'm just going to bring you back into view. There you
We
are.
can see you.
Okay. And now my screen's got a little smaller, right? But all right, let me just pull, see if I can enlarge
Are
this.
there any questions from the folks listening? You could raise your hand on Zoom, or you could just come off mute if you have questions. Any questions in the room? I have a lot, but I can't put them into words. Yeah, same. I think there's a lot of questions, but we can't quite form them into words. Oh, we have a
Okay,
question. We got
I can talk
one.
for okay.
Wait, we got one. Hold on.
Okay.
So when you say the people are paid early, is that regarding like the process of kind of like we accumulate something and when you have it?
Jen, I can't hear that person. I heard that when people are paid early.
I'll repeat it for you, but or you can try to say it loud, or I'll repeat it.
Okay.
When you paid early, is that in regards to if without the money, without the IOU, people will have to accumulate some type of worth or something of value to then give it to someone? And is the early meaning you don't have to wait, accumulate something?
Or you're right.
It's a great question. It's actually a really a question that goes to the heart of some of the things that monetary theorists are debating. Because if you, I'm going to ignore my screen for the moment. I realize it's not looking exactly right to you all, but I don't want to be too distracted by trying to get the picture to fill up the whole screen instead of talking to you. So if money was made this way, it does mean exactly as the person who asked this question perceived, that you don't actually need to have accumulated savings. The Union government didn't have any savings. That was exactly the problem, right? It could spend by giving IOUs. So it hadn't accumulated savings, and it can spend. Having said that, the Union government did have a resource that in a way it had accumulated, which is it had the tax obligation. People owed the government taxes. And the problem in wartime is, they know that taxes are coming in for the next 5 years, but that doesn't help them, in 1861. So they do have a real resource, which is the ongoing obligation of people in the community to pitch in, to make a contribution. And what they're doing is writing an IOU that says this is a credit towards your taxes, and they know that they're gonna actually be accepting those IOUs. So the IOUs never were good for gold. They're not an IOU for anything that was other than the obligation, you know, exonerating people from their existing obligation. So it's a credit that works as a set off to the obligation that people owe the government, if you will. And in that way, they're like repackaging. Think of it. And this is really interesting, you know, constitutionally, and constitutional scholars don't pay enough attention to this at all. But it's a kind of profound constitutional moment where they're saying, we're going to take political obligations, which you are going to make for us every week or every month or every year in labor or other resources like your horse, you know, horses or crops or whatever else you had to pay. And we're now going to take it in the shape of this money. It starts because they need to anticipate, you know, they want to draft some people early. We're going to give them a credit. And then when their time comes around, instead of taking their crops, we're going to take this credit back from them. So they know that they're just giving out a credit and then taking it back as a set off against their crops. And there is real stuff coming into the government. It just wasn't coming in fast enough. So they hadn't accumulated anything, but they do have this stream of real value coming to them. Okay,
There's a question in the chat. I'm not sure maybe you'll be getting to this, but from Carolyn, how do we think the current monetary system arose if not by the gold silver standard?
So I think it arose exactly this way, right? So this is, and the greenback is a great example of it's literally what the government did in 1861. So let me go on to give you another, to build a part of the architecture that makes it look more modern, right? Once we see that first building block, it really takes us to the second issue that I was going to talk about, which is if we've seen that money is actually an IOU, right, from the government that you can use on your taxes and for other, and you can use with each other, then the question is, you know, how else could it be designed? How does it relate to silver and gold? To silver and gold is actually the person's question. And how does it relate to more modern forms of money? So let me take those two questions one at a time. The greenback was the most straightforward way, the most transparent way of creating money, but you could create a money that contained metal. So before the greenback, the medieval way of creating money was actually to pay people. So probably in, you know, the fifth century or whatever, you know, that kind of early world that I was imagining, asking you to imagine, probably in that world, the warlords who were dominating at that point paid their elite warriors with tokens of silver and gold and agreed when they wanted their labor early, right? And agreed to take it back when those people paid them tribute. So it's the same logic, but they put like metal, think of it, the metal as collateral in the token. There's nothing that says the token has to, nothing in the logic that says the token has to be made of paper, right? In a world that's very uncertain, where political authority is more risky and where you might get, you know, into war with another clan or something, or another tribe, you might, and where the political authority of a warlord might be destroyed by that, you might want to have some silver or gold fallback value. It wouldn't be money if your warlord were wiped out. You know, the token wouldn't hold value as money, but it would still be silver and gold. So it seems likely that you know, certain authorities started putting silver and gold in their tokens to make them more credible. And that's a different monetary design. So it's like the greenback in terms of it is an IOU from the government. They would take it back. The warlord promises to take it back for the same value they paid it out at. But it meant, and this became the medieval way of making money. And it worked differently from the greenback because it had metal in it. And that meant a whole lot of interesting things. So it meant, for example, that governments needed metal to make new tokens. They couldn't easily expand their money supply. So prices were really low, right? People worked for a penny or two a day because there was very little money in circulation and all of it was very valuable. So it really mattered that they had chosen to make money, not in paper, but in metal. There were lots of problems with making money out of metal or putting money, metal collateral into money. So coins wore out. And kings had to constantly be going in and trying to re-mint the money. People clipped money because they were always trying to steal silver and gold and use it for other things. Coin, as I mentioned, it was very had a lot of value. So things cost only a penny. And that meant that it was really hard to do small exchanges. Like people couldn't go out and just buy a drink for lunch. Because, you know, if you only got paid a penny a day, you couldn't, there was no fractional or very little fractional change. So the whole kind of market and economy was different because the monetary design was different. It was a really interesting world. And it stayed, the medieval, the Europeans at least, the West in the world, kept using coin, you know, through the 18th century. And occasionally some other things, but it was a really, it was a money, a kind of money with many, many problems. And so the British started experimenting with different forms of money, and the Americans adopted one of those forms also in the Civil War. So I'm just gonna click on here. Let's see. All right, now I'm gonna have to try to figure out. Are you seeing my slides?
Yes.
You are.
Yeah. But it doesn't, you're not in presenter mode, it seems
I'm
like.
I'm not in presenter mode. So I need to go slideshow. Mm-hmm. Let's see.
I think from current slide or something.
Yeah. Okay. So now perfect. I think I'm in slideshow, but now I can't see you for some reason. So I'll click perfect. Out of this. All right.
Yeah.
When we need to talk. All right. So here's our second point. Money can be made in different ways. I talked about coin, but in fact, banks have become the new main money creators. And this is the sort of modern money design that also came about in the Civil War. So now what you're seeing is, so 1861, 1862, the government relies on greenbacks because that's the fastest way to start spending. But in 1863 and 1864, the government said to itself, well, the way the British have been making money, this is the big breakthrough that really brought the modern world, in my view. The way the British had been making money for 100 years, or for by the time of the Civil War, for 200 years, was to use banks, and in particular, banks that could lend to the government. So the Bank of England starts lending to the government. So stay with me here. If you look at the slide and you see the government, what it's going to do is recognize different groups of investors that it calls banks. There you see them in the middle of the picture. And then it's going to write them a long-term IOU, otherwise known as a bond, right? So it gives the banks a bond that says, we agree to repay you in 1868. Right? Give us 5 years. So we agree to pay you in 1868 if you will lend us money. And the banks lend the government money in banknotes. They don't lend the government silver and gold coin because it's the Civil War. They don't have any silver and gold coin, right? So the earliest national banknotes that the United States used were these from these national banks were promises to pay by the banks that they give to the federal government. The federal government then spends those banknotes. That's the top era where you see bank IOUs going into circulation. And then they accept those bank IOUs back for taxes. So if you think about that story, it's basically the same as the greenbacks. This time the money's coming from banks, right? And in fact, the government is supporting the bank money. So why do they do this, right? They had a perfectly good method of spending money into circulation and taxing it back. So why do they create a middleman, which are the banks, give them long-term IOUs, take their banknotes, their promises to pay instead of just keeping direct promises from the government, then spend the bank promises and tax the bank promises in, right? Why do that? Well, a lot of reasons. So what the British had found out is if you set up a system like this, you create allegiance on the part of the bankers, right? On the part of the wealthy elites, the investors who are now organized as banks. Those long-term IOUs, those long-term promises to pay back the banks by the government carry interest. So the banks are profiting. And the banks are then sending out their own IOUs, which are being supported, right? So it's a very effective system for borrowing from investors and bringing investors into alliance with the government. And you may not, the banks may also lend you existing silver and gold if they have it at this point, or existing greenbacks if they have them. The system had another really big advantage, though, that I haven't mentioned. And that is that once you set up a system like this, you can also, there's an example of the, if the reason I put this picture in is to show you the difference, right? Before, the old notes, the greenbacks said United States note, this says Federal Reserve note, because it's coming from the Federal Reserve Bank. That would be established a bit later, but you get the idea, right? There were smaller banks in the beginning, and all of those banknotes said Federal Reserve note, National Bank note. On the back, they also were, if you look down at the language at the very bottom, it says this note is receivable by all national and member banks and Federal Reserve banks, and for all taxes, customs, and other public dues. So it was also taken in and supported by the same kind of credit loop that the greenback was. So I want to just add this, go back to the second reason why banks were added to the repertoire, to the design alternatives that the US was using. The government could borrow from banks, but once banks existed, people could also borrow from banks. So if you notice now I've added, we see another kind of loop on the right-hand side with personal IOUs. This is when you go to a bank, you commit, or if you're looking for a farm loan, the personal IOU here is what I mean, right? You go to the bank and you agree to repay the bank in, say, 5 years. And the bank advances you bank money. So what this innovation did was create a way for people to directly participate in expanding the money supply, right? Not only could the government borrow from banks, but people could borrow from banks. And that turned out to be extremely productive because governments don't always spend enough to keep enough money in circulation. So the Civil War was a great military expansion. The government was spending a lot, but once it's winding down, the government's still taxing and the money's coming back in, and people wanted a way to expand the money supply themselves. So if they borrowed from banks directly, they could expand the money supply. This was like in the medieval world, people would go to the mints with their silver and gold and buy more coin. So every kind of system, every system that has a big, every economy that is monetary has a way for individuals to also be expanding the money supply. Okay, so this gets more complicated, and we can talk about the complexities if people want, because banks did have to promise after the Civil War, during the Civil War, they only had to promise greenbacks. If people wanted to come cash their banknotes, the banks would give them greenbacks. So the banks are not supposed to lend so much. They're lending more than the greenbacks they hold, but they are on the hook for giving people greenbacks if they want it. After the Civil War, they're going to change back to holding silver and gold coin, and that will be their reserve, they're lending much more than their reserve. As we know, banks lend much more than their reserve, but they do have that reserve that connects them, right, to the kind of ultimate kind of government money, whether it's greenbacks or in the old days coin, silver and gold coin. Okay, so if we think about this picture as opposed to the greenback, then the question is, you know, what are the implications? The implication is that instead of the government being the actor that's driving money into circulation, the actor that's driving money into circulation or agreeing to put money into circulation are investors. And this is why finance is so much more important in the modern world than in the pre-Civil War world or in the ancient world, because banks are now the money creators, and banks are acting on the profit motive. So these are commercial banks. They're retail commercial banks that the government charters during the Civil War and delegates the authority to make money. And thinking a little bit further, so banks are in a new central position in the economy. They're delegated the authority to make money. They're profiting from the authority to make money. They're also deciding who gets access to the money. So only people who are profitable, to, you know, who the bank thinks will pay back their personal IOUs or for whom they want to profit, those are the people to whom banks are lending. And this is immediately, the banks will always lend to the government because the government's good for it, right? The government has the tax power after all. So it's always, banks are almost always going to lend to the government. But the bank won't lend to all sorts of people. People who have a long project, like in many ways, farmers have a longer turnover that they're going to need, a longer time horizon. Banks after the Civil War is also, after the Civil War, lent in very discriminatory ways. They didn't lend to Black Americans by and large. And as we'll see in a few minutes, they also didn't lend to people with agrarian interests, as I'll talk about. But from this, I'll stop here to also see if people have questions. From this picture, you can see why finance would become more and more important. So once we have this design, which is a different design from greenbacks, a different design from coin, right? Greenbacks, just that transparent credit and repaying. Coin, same kind of credit and repaying, but carrying metal collateral. Now, you know, spending and repayment, but with banks in the middle, a new middleman, those banks are the root of a whole new system. So we can add, see if I did this, we can add a central bank. This is basically the modern system as you see it now. We add a central bank to support the banks. That gets very complicated, a whole nother set of discussions. We start trading bonds, all those long-term IOUs, and the banks can trade the personal IOUs that they're getting. We start building up capital markets, which are the trade in those bonds and personal IOUs. All of this according to the profit motive and profit maximization, which is the compass for the new modern system. So I'll stop there and see if there are questions there. Any questions about this new step, the financialization? I would say that what we've done when we talk about these new designs, the most important new design, as I said, is that banks become the agents for money creation in the modern world. This is really what capitalism is, right? A world in which we're taking a public medium, which is money, and we're giving it to banks to create and hand out. Any questions or comments?
Okay, it might take me a minute to get to the fact, but you just spoke to maximizing profit. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to the bank's role in history in not only like generating profit, but wealth and privilege hoarding and accumulating wealth and and with a lens of like privilege and self-protection for like the powerful people at the time.
This is another question that goes right to the heart of the design changes that we're seeing. If we go back, I mean, Americans first started talking about banks. I told you this story through the Civil War because that's when the federal government gets serious about banking. But they'd been playing with banks before that, in the decades before that. And Alexander Hamilton was this famous, you know, one of the founders who was completely smitten with the British method of banking. And so he's operating out of the revolution at the constitutional moment, and his arguments are all about privilege. So his arguments were all about the way that we build. This is the first bank in the United States. It didn't last, and you know, the Americans, as I said, are just experimenting, and the federal government doesn't stick with a bank. But if Alexander Hamilton had had his way, they would have. And a lot of the framers are convinced by his arguments. He says basically, you need to have debt, that is those long-term IOUs that we can still see, even though I haven't gotten the screen quite right. You need to have debt because rich people want to hold debt and rich people want to profit from it. And once you've got the wealthy invested in the government, they'll support the government. It becomes in their interest for the United States to succeed. And so we're binding elites to the government. And he had complete confidence in elites. He thought elites would be reasonable and moderate and wouldn't be greedy. But in the meantime, he's setting up a system that's basically built on elite privilege. And of course, if you give banks the ability to figure out what's profitable to who it is profitable to lend to, they're also going to engage in whatever conduct they want to in terms of lending to people. So the first bank in the United States that Hamilton helped get established, argued for and got established, only lent to Federalists and not to Jeffersonians, right? So the beginning, there's this very, very political game about who got loans. And that's part of the reason, it's literally part of the reason why it went down. It lasts about two decades, and then and then it expires and Congress doesn't restart it. And part of that was because it'd been lending in a very partisan way. It becomes even more tragic after the Civil War when the Union government, the North, sets up these banks. I mean, think about the fact that the greenback and even the banks, in many ways during the war, they're emancipatory institutions, right? They're helping fund the Civil War and helping the Union succeed and therefore emancipate, you know, 4 to 5 million people who are enslaved. Having said that, the banks, after the Civil War, what happens is a couple decades of struggle about how the monetary system as well as Reconstruction was going to happen. And along the way, the Supreme Court decided, among other things, that so-called private activity was not constitutionally, was not subject to constitutional oversight, which meant that for due process and equal protection. And that meant that you don't even really need the technical sort of legal doctrine to get the idea that these banks, they wouldn't be policed, is what the Supreme Court was doing, because they were doing so-called private activity. And that meant that the banks, as I said, didn't lend to Black Americans. They didn't lend to poor farmers in the Southwest. And they didn't lend. A couple decades later, there's a memo by the American Bankers Association that says, we recommend to our member banks that you not lend to union shops, to employers who have unionized employees. I mean, it's just basically outrageous on its face, right? That we would be creating this private, profit-driven channel as the main channel for the way money flows into our economy. But that's the way we do it. And we still do it that way today. Now, I will say part of the reason that that banks got away with it, if you will, is that it's also a really powerful system and a really productive system. So you have, you know, I mentioned the coin system in the Middle Ages. It's really clunky. It's really hard to operate. It's constrained by metal and gold supplies. And banks, as we know today, we could go through the whole metal and gold story, but as we know today, we don't need metal and gold to make this happen, right? All you need is the logic in the picture. Right. All you need is government spending and taxing, banks putting out obligations and requiring people to repay, governments making obligations and require and repaying them. Right. So it's a credit logic that creates the value. And that value was really productive. Right. When banks came in, they irrigated the economy, and we got all sorts of development, economic development. The problem is that we didn't get it in equitable ways, right? So the problem is, as the question suggests, exactly about distribution. It's not, you know, yeah, there was a lot of productive capacity in these banks, but we didn't get them in a productive, I mean, in an equitable way. And I think you can see that, you know, in some ways, it's all the more obvious to us today in a way that was hard to put your finger on 2 decades ago. But after 2008, you know, we all saw the big players get bailed out. The banks get bailed out. They're too important to fail. They don't even have to be that big. they're the essential creation of money in our society. So the Fed couldn't let them fail, but could let the homeowners fail, because any individual homeowner wasn't that important. And you know, so similar things under last spring, there was a run on a bank, SVB, and the Fed again rushed in and bailed out the bank, didn't want to let the bank fail. It's not so concerned about any individual depositor.
So I have a question. You mentioned, so this Supreme Court ruling that private activity is not subject to constitutional oversight, does that still hold in relation to banks and lending, or was that Civil Rights Act?
It's remarkably resilient. So the Civil Rights Act of 1964 didn't include banks. It's just amazing. And then there have been a couple acts since then, including the Community Reinvestment Act and the Equal Access to Credit Act. In the, I forget which years those are, 1970s and 80s, I mean, very late and relatively modest. So the policing of banks is still relatively modest. And mostly it's a shaming thing at this point and an exposure, which is, you know, have made banks less blatant about their discriminatory lending. But having said that, I mean, this really anticipates the need for a public bank, for example, your questions, because if you think about it, you know, the American economy is so now stratified. If you think, we have these numbers that show that, for example, Black Americans have, you know, drastically lower incomes than white Americans on average. And if that's the case, then banks don't really need to discriminate anymore. Right? They're just making business decisions now to say those people are higher risk. They don't have as much capital. I don't have, you know, evidence of credit history, a whole number of things in which people who have been disadvantaged historically will present as being less worthy of a bank loan, even on, you know, pure business rationales today. So the problem is that banks, good faith bankers, of whom I'm sure there are many, right? I mean, it's their business model is to go make a profit, and they're not going to cure the problem of a stratified economy by themselves, because their business model, even without discriminating anymore, is going to disadvantage people who were disadvantaged in the past. So we have a big problem left that's beyond, you know, it's beyond the farming problem, but it's actually not disconnected, right? We'll talk. I mean, farmers have historically also been disadvantaged and had real difficulty getting credit. And the banks are not, it's not in their business model to cure that problem.
We get a lot of questions.
Institutional racism. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I had a question.
I was always wondering if there's something like by law, like why the banks or any loan people would give an 18-year-old student a loan for $100,000 for school, but if that same individual wanted a loan to start a business or to open up a farm, they wouldn't be able to get that opportunity. So I was wondering that if there's something like by law that, you know, you have to give a student loan, or is it just something that the bank feel more safe in that investment?
It is a great question. The student loan market is structured by the federal government. And I don't know the details, but I'm sure the answer turns on a federal government regulation of that lending. And that's not true for the farmers. I mean, we have to investigate more about exactly what the farmers are up against, but the student loans and the ability to get them are distinct and special because the federal government basically controls that market. And I don't know enough about the details to take you further in that, except to say that it's a distinct market. So that's why you're seeing that difference.
Well, Christine, could one, to your point on risk, would the inability to discharge through bankruptcy be seen as probably a risk mitigation factor for the bank? To essentially create a debt surf for the entirety of someone's career.
So you're saying if you can't discharge by bankruptcy, could you be rendered, you're saying, sort of in debt peonage indefinitely?
Yes.
Well, it certainly seems like that's happened in the past. So this kind of brings us forward to, you know, could we think of other ways to structure the system? And let me use it in some ways to get to the third point. It might, then the third point, which is, you know, sort of what are other ways of structuring the system, might answer some of these questions. But the questions are all like right on in terms of the kind of thinking we have to do to get us to a better place. And so you're going to have more questions than I have information, but that's good. That's a good sign. So let me see if I can get back. Let's see if I can get back to putting this full screen.
Can I just
All right.
Just a follow up on that Civil Rights Act point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We talk a lot about Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which, you know, prohibits discrimination under any program receiving federal dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll even say it like a lot of people who talk about Title VI will say, any program that receives even $1 of federal funds, you're subject to like compliance with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. But mm-hmm. basically what you're saying are the people that actually create those dollars for the federal government are not being held to that standard. They can discriminate freely.
Well, the equal access to I'm never forgetting what the name of the Equal Access to Credit Act does have limitations on banks now, but they don't have a lot of teeth. So I don't know how they'd compare with Title VI's guarantee.
Well, and just to your point, Jen, those bailouts come direct from the Federal Reserve, usually not necessarily from the government. Is that not the case, Christine?
The bailouts to banks?
Yeah.
They come from the Federal Reserve, which is basically a public agency, although that's a whole nother topic, right? The Federal Reserve is a public agency, but it's composed of commercial banks, right? It actually represents the commercial banks. So it's a very captured system. And if you think, let me just, before we go, I want to get a few more things on the table, but just to loop around to the very beginning of our talk, when we started talking, if you think about the nature of the system, right, none of this is obvious. The nature of the system, the fact that banks are controlling the injection of money into circulation, and the fact that the Federal Reserve is like an umbrella acting for the commercial banks, as well as having duties to the public, right? So there's a statute that regulates the Federal Reserve, but it is composed of member banks. None of that's transparent to people. And people don't think to ask the kind of questions you're asking, because if you think back to where we started, if you have a story that money's just an item that came to hand as people were bartering and it's all private and really communities don't have anything, you know, it's not a community, a collective, orchestrated, engineered system. It's just a thing that came to the top of, you know, rose to the top of the soup of barter. If you're thinking that, you don't ask all these questions. Once you see that it's actually a kind of credit, and then that there were different ways to make it, different kinds of credit, and different structures that could be used, then the whole system is up for grabs, right? We could do much better than we've done. We could make a money, as this is the third thing I just wanted to get to. So let me say a few more things about it, and then, you know, totally go back to your questions, which are right on point. So somebody asked, or we were talking about farmers as opposed to, say, students. This actually came up after the Civil War. So when the war was over, the federal government gradually retired the greenback. So the greenback, which was actually a very democratic form of money, right, direct from the government, direct back in, they retire that, and they rely only on banks. And what happened is that the farmers of the Southwest were left without much money, because the South, any pre-existing banks, you know, the Americans had been experimenting for decades before the Civil War, and there'd been a lot of state banks, and those were mostly destroyed by the Civil War. And the national banks that the federal government brought in during the Civil War were mostly in the North, right? Because we had just, you know, we'd started it in the North. We started that system in the North. So the farmers in the Southwest were basically starving for credit. And what they had to do was go to these intermediaries, these called factors, these merchants who agreed to lend to them at exorbitant levels, only if the farmers mortgaged their crop to those merchants. And you can guess what happened, right? They'd borrow from the merchants, they'd mortgage their crops, fall would come, the harvest would come, the merchants would sell the crops for the farmers and say, sorry, you didn't succeed in paying off your debt completely. You'll have to borrow more money from me. And the thing would repeat every season. So this was the beginning of what became known as the agrarian populist movement, which mobilized several million people at its height. So we're talking now 1880s. And what they did was create is they learned about the monetary system, and they thought, you know, and they tried, I skipped a step, that first they tried to borrow from banks. So the agrarian populist leaders organized a big cooperative. They convinced people to sacrifice an enormous amount of collateral, and people put up either their labor or their land as collateral. And then this collective, which took place in Texas, had leaders, and they went to the banks to get a loan, because they thought, if we get a collective loan, we'll get a better rate from the bankers, and then we won't be held hostage by the merchants. We'd also have collective points of sale. We'll sell outside the merchants that were extracting all this profit. And what happened is the banks refused to lend to them. Just solidarity with the merchants. And they shut down the agrarian movement, right? Or they tried to shut it down. So what the farmers did next, having educated themselves about money is and knowing about the greenback, is they said, why don't we ask the federal government, I'm going to go forward here. This was their proposal. If the government could, if you recognize the slide, right, the outer loop is the greenbacks, right, the government spending into circulation and then taxing back in. I should have crossed out people and put farmers. The agrarian populace, this movement, suggested that they would borrow, putting up their collateral to the government, not to the banks, and the government should lend to them directly. So it was like greenbacks, but instead of being spent into circulation, the government would lend to the farmers, and that would allow them to escape the debt trap that they were in, the debt peonage that they were in, and then the farmers could you know, basically produce for themselves and retain their land. And what happened was, it was probably 1889, this lost in Congress, probably because of the power of the banks. And the that was the end of the agrarian movement, basically. But if you can see, the logic, what they were trying to do was break out of the bank logic. And it was a brilliant, I think it was a brilliant proposal. And it all came out of farmers, because they recognized the importance of credit, of getting credit, and the way they could be held hostage, because they had to get credit before they could spend on, you know, on their farms. The last thing I'll mention, and then just open it up for questions, is it does seem to me that something like the agrarian populist logic could work. That is to say, we could have something like this, like what they tried before, if we could get the political clout. The reality of today is that the banks are so powerful that you kind of have to assume this system, right? Or that a different strategy would be to assume that banks remain institutionally important, but add public banks. There are various initiatives for public banking. There's one in Massachusetts. I think it would be great to have one in Vermont, because you might actually get something done, whereas Massachusetts will just sit on this for years, I think, unfortunately. But there's no reason that banks, if we think about all the things we've talking about, have to be structured and run and operated for private profit. A state could charter its own bank and put some capital in there, appropriate some capital, put some public revenues in there to act as the depository base, and then lend against those deposits and that capital. And this has been done many times. There's a public bank in North Dakota, believe it or not, which was a residue of that, was kind of the last gasp of the early populists. They succeeded in getting a bank in California. It's still running. But earlier in the century, in the 19th century, there had been a lot of experimentation. In that era of experimentation, there were public banks also. So we could try something like that. And the last thing I'll say is, just picking up on Jen's work and all of your work, Michael's work, you know, if farmers can get in the White River District or anywhere else, right, in Virgin Islands or in Vermont, can get a contract with the federal government, but then need to go borrow money in order to need to borrow and spend money before getting reimbursed by the federal government, you could imagine farmers actually borrowing from a public bank instead of commercial banks at a lower rate, right? Because it would be public and not interested in profit maximizing, but interested in public welfare more generally. So imagine you get grants in Vermont, EQIP grants, then instead of going to commercial bank, you go to a Vermont public bank, they lend you the money, and the Vermont public bank then gets repaid by the federal government. Be a great deal for the Vermont public bank, because it's guaranteed to get repaid, and a better deal for farmers, because they'd be borrowing at a lower rate. So what that would take would be another kind of redesign. We're just seeing another, a last kind of redesign on the screen. If we're thinking, once we see how things work, we could imagine a public bank. Okay, I'm going to go off the main chart again so that I can see you and hopefully pick up more questions.
When you say a public bank, what does that actually mean?
Great question. People often use the word in different ways. And so you always have to ask somebody just your question, what do you actually mean? So what I was referring to is the kind of bank that we've proposed in Massachusetts, and what it, the way it would be set up is the states today, along with the federal government, charter banks. So these banks that we've been talking about are all creatures of governments. They have to go get a charter from a government. They have to incorporate and get bank privileges. When you get a charter as a bank, you get a bunch of privileges, which is include this privilege to create the money supply. And so the public banks, the kind of public bank I'm talking about would be a public bank chartered by the state, but granting itself the same powers it grants right now to banks. So instead of, know, the state of Massachusetts currently charters, say, the Cape Cod First Bank, First State Bank. It would charter the Massachusetts Public Bank. So then it's set up a bank. It's granted that bank the same privileges as the Cape Cod Bank to create money, to lend to people against some kind of promise of repayment. And that means that that public bank would get privileges, you know, would also have the Fed as its backup. And the way the state would operate the public bank would be, it would give it, it would appropriate some capital, say 200 million in state funds. And then it would take state revenues to create deposits for the banks. This kind of gets, your question is taking us into deep water, in the sense that it we'd have to talk about how banks work, but the way banks work is they actually operate like a network with each other. So they have a very small reserve and they have all this credit out based on how big their depository base is. So the public state bank could say have a depository base of 1.6 billion. So let's say it's a 1.8 billion bank overall, including the capital. That means it can lend that much money into circulation. So it will take promises from people, from farmers, and it would actually be able to pay out that much money using the public revenues as its kind of network, the way it's keyed into the network of other banks. So this is hard to, we should get out the balance sheets and look at them. But the bottom line is that banks leverage their capital by like 8 or 10. So the capital, the amount that a state actually would have to newly set aside would be small, like 1/8 or 1/10 of how much lending that bank could actually do. So it's a really cost-effective way. That's the bank business model. They're all doing that. They're all taking a small amount of capital and they're leveraging it through this network of credit. And that's a whole nother talk, like how they leverage it through this network of credit. But for now, if you take it on faith, you get the idea, right, that they're all using this network of credit and they're leveraging up their capital. And the state could do the same thing very safely, especially if it's doing something like lending to farmers who are going to get repaid by the federal government. So that's the kind of public bank that I'm talking about. Other people, sometimes people are talking about postal banks, for example, that would hold retail deposits from individuals. That's a whole different kind of enterprise, which could also be, that is also a kind of redesign, but it wasn't the one that I was talking about here. I was just trying to think about here, I was thinking more about how do we fund the kind of farming you want to do. And that, so that's the kind of public bank we're talking about here is a public bank based on state revenues and state capital and lending to farmers, small businessmen, you know, underserved communities, all the people who've been left out in the past.
So a question from the crowd, a pretty simple question. Why can't the USDA do exactly this? The federal agency.
Could the USDA charter a public bank?
Or just give directly to the farmer. But yeah, or charter.
So I think the federal government could get much more creative than it's doing, right? So I'm enough of I don't know enough about the USDA to know what's in their statute. It probably doesn't. You probably need to adjust their statute, right? But in some ways, that question reminds me of let's see if I can go back to this. You know, the federal government could be lending directly to farmers. So again, apologies that I don't have it pretty here up for you, but you get the idea. That it seems to me that question is basically taking a page out of the agrarian populist book. And I think they had a brilliant proposal, which was just let us, you know, borrow directly from the federal government and let the federal government directly create money for us. The federal government basically doesn't do that anymore. The way the federal government works today is, so let's see if I can get, you know, here's the federal government today, right? There. And the way the federal government works, even when it lends money, I'm just moving that so I can see it as well as you. If you see what's happening, the federal government, maybe you can see my cursor, when it borrows money, even to fund USDA things, it puts a bond with the banks, it borrows from the banks, and then it spends the money. So it's also always working through the financial architecture. It really doesn't need to do that. It doesn't need to do that. It has the power and the authority. It could do the more straightforward kind of lending, but it's always working through the banks today because they made the commitment that that's the architecture they were going to support and elaborate.
So that's the appropriation process. It's just the government borrowing money from a bank.
Right. Right. I mean, the appropriations process is when the government deciding how much to spend.
Right.
Right. So the government's deciding how much to spend. And then when it needs to raise the money, it's taxing, right? So partly it's just bringing in money from taxes. That's this bottom arrow, right? It's taxing the bottom arrow. But it's also when it borrows the long-term debt that the government is holding is because the government has issued bonds and taken bank credit. And then it's spending that to round up what it didn't get from taxing. And it's always doing it that way, as opposed to, you know, the more straightforward way, which would be this way.
So Christine, there are these revolving loan rural development programs. I don't know if you're aware of them. So what's stopping Jennifer, myself, or any other NRCD, it wouldn't be making us a bank, but at the very least, we'd be able to lend out sufficient funds to fund the conservation practices that we're trying to do for any given year. Do you see value in that kind of quick fix workaround in the lead possible larger movement?
Yes. Yes. So I don't work myself with revolving loan funds, partly because I've been focusing on these efforts to redesign the architecture. The revolving loan funds, depending on their terms and conditions, could be a great option for people. They're not changing the architecture, right? They're instead trying to find a pool of funds that already exists, collect it, and lend it at good terms to people for good reasons, right? So it seems to me they are, depending on their terms, a great option for people. And that, you know, then when the money's repaid, that money exists. So it's kind of more like a self-help, you know, within the system. Could we think of ways, a self-help response? Can we segregate some money and use it for good purposes and with good terms and conditions? Yes, that can be done. So I think there's real potential there. I just don't focus on them myself because they're not going to transform the system, right? The system
What I think I'm getting at is in a long enough time horizon, if we're harvesting even a small amount of interest off of the loans written for those conservation practices, even if it's 75% of the standard interest rate, we could theoretically build up a sufficient capital base to initiate the formation of our own small localized mutual bank or cooperative bank. I don't know the right term, but is that something that you've ever seen an example of, or is it theoretically possible?
It sounds to me theoretically possible. And there's a long tradition in the United States of people setting up credit cooperatives, you know, like the credit unions and mutual savings banks and banks that are basically supposed to be operated on a less than profit driven mission, right? So there is a long tradition of Americans and often philanthropists trying to start institutions that will lend on better terms. Amalgamated Bank is, as I understand it, kind of the remaining union bank that lends to union members in particular. So there was a tradition of unions actually chartering banks and trying to run banks that were oriented towards giving union members better credit terms than conventional banks would. The reason I'm kind of using the past tense a lot is that the people who have studied them argue that those banks again and again kind of get competed out or lose their mission after a while. I don't see why that's necessarily the case, but I will say that in some ways it's a harder, the advantage of the public, on the one hand, what you're mentioning is within your control and you could do it. I don't see any reason why you couldn't. And you could apply for a charter just like anybody else. So yeah, more power to you. And it has that going for you, right? So what I was going to mention as the advantage of the public bank and the public route is simply that that the public character of it would allow for risk and cost spreading over the whole body of taxpayers, so that a public bank doesn't have to compete the same way that you would with a small mutual credit bank. So the Bank of North Dakota, for example, has the whole tax base, it holds all the public revenues. So it's never in danger of being out, you know, being competed out of existence or of losing its mission, right? Because although some people say it's not progressive enough, right? That it's too interested in supporting the commercial bank. So maybe it has lost its mission some ways, but it has great advantages because it's public. That it would be nice if we could harness on your behalf. So I guess the bottom line seems to me is, yeah, try everything. Revolving loan funds, your own mutual credit bank, and a public bank. Why not try them all and see if we could, you know, what things would actually result in transformative finance as well as, you know, transformative agriculture.
So there's one question in the chat, and then I guess if you have any final words for us, I don't know if you could see the chat, but the question is, could a public bank be created by a large group of citizens pooling funds?
Such a good question. You mean outside, could it be? So I think I'm going to interpret that question as saying, could a large group of citizens capitalize a public bank, right? Make it still public, as opposed to the well-intended mutual credit bank, which we've already seen could exist and, you know, be like Amalgamated or these other banks that were mission-driven. Certainly that latter thing is possible. It's also, I think it's a really interesting suggestion. Could citizens capitalize, provide the capital for the legislature, therefore removing the roadblock that they might come up with saying, I'm sorry, we can't afford, we don't have the capital right now, we don't want to appropriate. But if the citizens came forward and said, we'll appropriate the money, will you establish a public bank? Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I don't see why it couldn't happen. We talked briefly about it in Massachusetts, and we're kind of worried about you know, maybe big private interests taking over, but we also didn't get very far in brainstorming it because we didn't have any real prospect in mind of people coming forward with money. It does remind me, to say one last thing about that proposal, it does remind me of the fact that in the 19th century, in those decades of experimentation before the Civil War, when they were trying all sorts of different things, including all sorts of different banks, there were a lot of banks that were hybrid banks, public-private, like the private would put in, you know, a fifth of the capital or something like that, and private shareholders would put in the rest. There were a lot of deals where states would condition charter, say, we'll only grant you a charter and if you agree to fund, I think this was Connecticut, if you agree to fund education, to lend to educators or something like that. So there's a lot of things possible, and we've kind of lost the creative gene, with the exception of these questions, actually. I feel like we've lost our creativity, and it's exactly this kind of thinking that we have to do to brainstorm our way back. I think, Jen, that might be a place to stop,
yeah,
because
beautiful.
If you think about, the last several questions have been, you know, what about this design? What about that design? Could we do this? It's amazing how much we could do. If we see the architecture, yes, a lot of these things are possible. And I would love to be, I'd be happy to brainstorm with people. You know, we really just have to get creative and see what we could redesign.
Thank you so much, Christine. We really, really are honored.
Well, thank you. It was great to be a part of this.
Absolutely.
I think we should let